Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I am doing excellent. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing great, Lance. And for this episode, we have on one of our very best friends in the industry, this true crime media space. It's everybody's favorite Maggie, Maggie Freeling.
She is definitely the best Maggie that we know, possibly the best Maggie in this country. So good point there. She is our guest on our first appearance on the Outlier Podcast Festival, which was super fun. We were invited to close out the weekend's festivities.
Yeah, that was quite an honor to be a part of the Outlier Podcast Festival. And you can follow them on all social media platforms. And they're on Twitter at Outlier_HQ. And we were introduced to a nice gentleman by the name of Ever Gonzalez by our friend and colleague Josh Hallmark, who runs True Crime Bullshit, the podcast, the wonderful podcast. And so he's been associated with the Outlier Podcast Festival for a year or two now, and he introduced us, and we got a spot, and we had a great conversation with Maggie Freeling about journalism in podcasting.
Yeah, Maggie is a journalist. She was a public radio producer. She's from New York City, of course, and a lot of her journalism focuses on mental illness, criminal justice, and social issues, and we talked to her about being perceived as journalists in the podcast true crime genre. You and I are not journalists. Maggie is a seasoned journalist, and we work with journalists. So it was almost like trying to figure out how to define this new type of journalism and work together with the seasoned journalists and understand that you need to be humble in that approach.
Right. You can't really make an omelet without cracking a few eggs, Lance, and you can't do what we've done without making mistakes, a lot of mistakes. And you're right. You have to be willing to admit that they are mistakes and learn from them. And I think that's something that not everyone can do. So I'm happy that we have a friend like Maggie, who I think sees us as a teachable force. You know, obviously we're here with a platform to advocate for cases and expose injustices, and I think Maggie's along for the ride for all of that. But yeah, if we make mistakes, you got to learn from your errors. Absolutely.
That's correct. And we're still here, and Maggie's still here, and Maggie has a brand new show as well. It's called Unjust and Unsolved. If any show should be at the top of the Apple podcast charts, it should be Unjust and Unsolved. It's a program where she tackles innocent people who are locked away in prisons across the United States. There's a number out there, 20,000 innocent people are incarcerated, and Maggie interviews them. She tells a story, and this is a weekly podcast. Maggie interviews and tells a story about one person each episode who is unjustly incarcerated, and it's all for a good cause, and she will really try to expose the horrors of the criminal justice system when it's not used correctly, when it's abused. And very fascinating podcast. So check that out. It's Unjust and Unsolved, and it's unjustandunsolved.com.
Yes, great show. And you can find that on the Obsess Network. And so I hope you enjoy this episode, this conversation with Maggie Freeling from the Outlier Podcast Festival. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Be a lot of fun. Thanks a lot to the Outlier Podcast Festival for having us. I am Tim Polari of Crawlspace Media. We do the Missing Maura Murray podcast. We do Crawlspace and Empty Frames. And we run the Crawlspace Media Network. My partner here is Lance. What's up, Lance?
What is going on? This is the first time you've ever introduced me and not asked me how I was, so I don't know what to say.
Well, how are you?
I am doing better than ever. I'm so excited to be here. What a way to end the week. And we have our good friend, our partner in crime or anti-crime, Maggie Freeling is our guest for this evening. So,
hi, guys.
How's it going?
What's up?
It's going. I am exhausted, but it's going.
Long week?
Quite a long week. Quite a long month, but you know.
And you just launched your brand new podcast that is really you on your own. You have been on many podcasts, including ours, but you are also a part of NPR's Latino USA podcast. But now this is your own animal. Can you tell us a little bit about this podcast?
Yeah, so I have been a producer for many years for all sorts of public radio stations, NPR included, NPR shows. But yeah, so this is my first time having my own podcast where I am the host, reporter, producer, engineer. I do everything. It's fun. It's nice to be my own boss. It's nice to do my own things.
And you got this podcast started through the Obsessed Network, and the Obsessed Network is run by the creative minds, the hilarious and thought-provoking minds behind True Crime Obsessed and Obsessed with Disappeared. That's Patrick Hines. Can you tell us a little bit about your history with those folks, and how did that all come to be?
Oh, boy. So my history with them is pretty similar to yours. You know, Patrick is equally as obsessed with all of us. And so I guess, you know, he saw the documentary, The Disappearance of Maura Murray on Oxygen. He covered it for his podcast because True Crime Obsessed covers in a very funny way true crime podcasts. So Patrick covered The Disappearance of Maura Murray. He saw all of us in it. And we met at CrimeCon. And, you know, we both live in New York City. So it was like, oh my gosh, let's get drinks. You know, I was working in Harlem at the time. His house is on the way back. I literally had to pass it on the train. So we got drinks and just started talking. And, you know, it just became him being like, look, I want to branch out. I want to make a network. I need to have you on my network. What do you want to do? And we ran through a few ideas and here we are.
Well, I got to say that you being on his network and having a podcast is much better than his first idea, which was wearing your hair on his body.
Yeah, he wanted to take all. He does have a Maggie wig, though, I think, like a, you know, and my coat. He, you know, he does what he does.
It works for him. I will say.
I think he looks better than I do, honestly.
He does wear it well. He does wear it well.
And I just want to say thank you to Josh Hallmark from True Crime Bullshit for hooking us up with this spot here with the Outlier Podcast Festival. He is a professional, consummate podcast professional. He's great. And he really kind of is sort of like us in the way where we are amateur journalists who sort of stumbled into a podcast career. Which actually happens to involve a lot of journalism, which is bizarre because that, you know, most amateurs, most people in an amateur field, you just can't really break through that professional level being an amateur. So we started our podcast, Missing Maura Murray, back in 2015, July of 2015. We've done almost 200 episodes on that case, and it's still going. The podcast led to the series, the Disappearance of Maura Murray, done by the Oxygen Network, which is when we met Maggie Freeling, which was, I believe we met her probably 2016.
I think we were filming in 2016. We met.
Okay. So really this amateur attempt that we started back in 2015 landed us all here, right now. And we're still amateurs. You're a professional. I guess one thing I'm curious about is what, as a professional journalist, what was it like hearing the Missing Maura Murray podcast at the beginning?
I mean, it must have been life-changing.
Yeah.
Well, in a sense, and I do, you know, I've been a fan of Josh and his podcast, and we haven't met or talked. So Josh, hello, thank you for putting everyone here. I would love to talk with you about Israel Keyes. So I just wanted to put that out there. But, you know, I thought it was so cool to hear your podcast. You know, I had been at that point in audio journalism. I guess I started 2014. I started in audio journalism at WHYY in Philadelphia. So I thought it was pretty cool what you guys were doing. And that was always something I wanted to do. I was like, how do I do this? How do I do this on my own? And over the years, I know I've asked you guys a lot of those questions. Like, how do I break away from public radio? How do I, you know, do my own thing and be my own boss? How do I start that? So I really admired you guys and thought that was very, very cool that you were doing that and making a living off of it. So I commend you. And that was really great.
Well, it brings us, thank you, but making a living is, I mean, we're raking it in hand over fist, first of all. But no, that brings us to the point of this conversation, which Tim kind of alluded at in the beginning of his intro there. We're not journalists. I remember back in the day when we started doing this, we said, you know, I feel weird even being called a journalist because people just assume you are a journalist if you're talking about something like a missing persons case or a cold case and you have some air of authority about yourself. The only reason why we did is because we had researched it a lot before we actually started talking behind a microphone, and it felt awkward. It felt very, very strange to talk to nobody and just know that it was being recorded onto something that would eventually go somewhere. It felt even more strange when people listened to it. And then they started calling Tim and I journalists, and we had to say, no, we're not journalists. And that's sort of the topic that we want to get at, which is where is the line between what you... I believe you graduated from UMass Amherst in 2011. Podcasting was pretty new. You know, it was there, but it wasn't at the true crime podcasting certainly wasn't.
I was doing podcasting in a journalism class. Maybe it was a communications class, journalism or communications class in 2009. And we were exclusively using GarageBand, like podcasting. Yeah. I remember looking at like one time, like a timeline of like when podcasting became big, and it obviously became big with Serial, but there were clearly, you know, others around. I think it was around 2009, like This American Life might've switched to podcast, something like that. I could be totally off, but it was around that like 2009 time, this like idea of podcasting became like a thing. Yeah. And you know, back to, you know, to your question, Tim, cause you asked and now Lance, you've asked about being a journalist versus, you know, I don't know, what would you guys call yourselves? Just podcasters, or are you citizen detectives in a sense?
Yeah, that's true. I think digital journalists, I have called myself that at times.
Yeah, I feel bad calling myself anything that I haven't earned a degree at except U.S. Marshal, because Tim knows and you know that Art Roderick has bestowed upon me the honorary U.S. Marshal title. Other than that, like if you say like journalists or digital journalists, I feel like I needed to go to school for that. So that's really my question, is where is the line?
I know that people would disagree with me, but I do think to be titled a journalist, I do think you'd probably, I have to say that you need to be, you know, trained in a sense. Like there are rules and there are ethics and there are things that you need to know. And, you know, I took all sorts of law and ethics classes for my master's, you know, like there are things that I just think you really need to know. And I think this is very much my personal belief, is that, you know, when we start calling people who might not have the same kind of, you know, ethics background, journalists, I do think it gets confusing for folks who are digesting news and are digesting media. That's not to say you can't be, you know, as informed or knowledgeable as a journalist. I just think, you know, the title really implies something that is different than, let's say, what you guys are doing, you know, when you mention what you're doing. And yeah, so back in school, my undergrad, 2009, you know, there wasn't really such thing as like what you guys are doing. There wasn't such thing as like a podcaster that people go to seek information. It was definitely different. You know, you got the news on the radio and you read it through journalists who have sources. And I do think now it is quite blurred. I just think, I don't know. And maybe, you know, tell me what you feel, but I think giving somebody the title of like, I am a journalist really implies a high bar and a high standard. And I know, you know, your podcast is so wonderful, but what you guys do is very different from what I do. You know, I do a lot of sourcing. I do a lot of, you know, record checking, and you guys do that. But I also know that you guys, you're quick with information in a sense, you know, you get the information out and then you'll go back and correct yourself. And for me, I would never, I can't do that as a journalist. I would never put something out if I hadn't.
What are you saying? We play fast and loose here?
Yeah, you're giving us way too much credit.
You guys, so
we don't correct ourselves.
A wonderful thing. You guys do a wonderful thing where you take these interviews. You're not claiming to be a journalist, which when you do, like I said, you know, there are, there's a really high bar put to that. So you don't claim that. You can do first person interviews and people can say things, you know, and it, I guess in a sense, it, you shouldn't obviously put out libel or slander in any way, but I think it's a little looser. You know, you can have somebody giving their first person account of things, but when someone does that with me, I still go and I fact check everything that they say before I put it out. I make sure I have documentation of what they're saying. It's definitely different, and you can yell at me all you want about that.
No, do you guys watch Always Sunny in Philadelphia, right?
Yes.
I feel like a journalist the way Charlie feels like a lawyer. You know when he calls himself a lawyer?
Bird law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bird law.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. In a sense, like, I guess, like, where is the, like, I don't know. Like, I think, I do think for someone to call themselves a journalist, I really do think you need to be trained in that sense.
Well, the amateur, I can do it, doesn't really exist in too many professions, if you think about it. Like, you can't just call yourself an amateur dentist and sit someone down in a chair.
Which I've done to myself.
Right. And you can do it, but you can't do it and call yourself a professional dentist.
There's repercussions.
Yeah.
And I think that there's, that's the point that I'm making. Like, I know that everything I do, there are repercussions for. That's what my career is based on, that I'm a journalist. So I have a lot of repercussions, but in that same sense, like, I don't think your career is necessarily at the same stake level. You know, you don't call yourself a journalist, and that's probably a good thing for you guys.
Hey, when you were in school for journalism, what were you thinking you were going to investigate, you know, like as an investigative journalist? Did you want to get into it for the investigative purposes? Like, I want to go shake things up or, you know, what was the, because that's what you do now. I'm Unjust and Unsolved. Your podcast is shaking things up and it's for a good cause. Is that like what you were thinking back in the day?
Always. I, you know, it's funny because when Patrick and I were trying to conceive this idea, it was like, he wanted to kind of do something similar to True Crime Obsessed, which was like funny. And I'm like, I'm not funny. Like, I'm very serious. I'm a very serious, like, academic journalist. I mean, I'm funny in my personal life, but like not in my work. It's just, that's not what I do. It's always very serious. I've never really covered anything that's light. I covered genocide and immigration and very really fun topics. So I did. I always thought, you know, in my head, I've always wanted to be like a Democracy Now, like Amy Goodman. Like, I've always wanted to be someone like that, just like doing on the ground, finding the truth, and really, you know, grassroots investigations and grassroots advocacy and grassroots reporting is always what I wanted to do. I really, you know, in school, I thought I was going to be kind of like an international reporter, and I always pictured myself like in Iraq.
Oh, no kidding. What was the appeal of that? Like, why Iraq? You wanted to?
Well, just like kind of war report or just like on the ground, you know, because I just think they're, you know, at the time, things are definitely different now, but at the time, I felt like we just were so sheltered from what was truly going on. And okay, so I had a bunch of a couple of very good friends at the time who were in Afghanistan and were telling me very scary top secret things. I had seen videos, you know, from cameras, and you know, it was just things I had never seen on the news, had never at the time heard reported. So I, you know, I always thought like, okay, that's something I want to do. I need to cover this. This is disturbing what is happening in these countries to civilians particularly. And it just went in a different direction because I think there are wonderful people there doing that kind of reporting now. And I felt we needed a little more reporting here at home.
Yeah. And I, what would the process be to even get into something like that?
That's a great question. I did for a while consider my safety in that kind of environment. You know, there are very few things that, like, you know, as a lot of us who digest true crime and a lot of media, you know, there are very few things that I can't see or watch. But when I do hear about reporters, you know, being held hostage, it's really disturbing. And that, like, really freaks me out because I think of how, you know, at least mentally close I was to being there. And so I think that really deterred me. You know, of course, there's a lot of danger in what we do. I mean, speaking about the Maura Murray case, I mean, it's just anytime you're vocal about something that there is a partisan side to, I think you do put yourself in any kind of danger.
Interesting point, because there's that old adage that says if you're not upsetting people, you're doing something wrong. Do you think that's true 100% of the time? Because you could just go and upset everybody all the time if you wanted to.
Well, yeah. It depends, because I did a story. I was down in Santa Fe reporting a story about this conquistador pageant that had been a tradition in Santa Fe for 100 years. This came out on NPR's Latino USA. And there was three sides to this story. There was the Pueblo indigenous people, who obviously a conquistador pageant really glorifies what happened, you know, in the mass slaughter and genocide and enslavement of the Pueblo people in New Mexico and Santa Fe. There are the Hispano people, that's what they call themselves. They're descendants from Spain who have also been on this land for a very long time. As we know, the conquistadors came a very long time ago, so they really do also consider themselves quite indigenous to the land. And then there were the Caballeros, who was this religious organization who ran the pageant. And so I was down there trying to be as fair to all sides when reporting this. And what was happening with all of these protests, and there was a lot of conflict going on about this pageant. As you can imagine, the Pueblo people were not happy about it. And the other side said, this is our heritage. It was really a coming moment with the Confederate statue. It was all happening at the same time. And pretty much everyone was mad at me about that article, that audio piece, except the Pueblo people, actually. They felt that was the first time their voices had been heard nationally, and they had messaged me. The activists that I had featured were really happy. But the Hispanos and the Caballeros were not happy. And I really, truly thought I gave them the fairest possible side that I could. I really went through this. Like, I did like these people. I liked them, and I tried to be really fair to them. And it's hard to do that when you're running a pageant about the genocide of a people. So, you know, that was my first instance where I was like, wow, nobody was happy with me for this. And I think I did my job correctly.
Yeah. What's that feel like, I guess? Because we've definitely experienced some of that too. We never really want to rock the boat or piss people off on purpose, but sometimes facts tend to do that. What's that been like in your case for that one especially?
I was a little bummed out about that one. You know, a lot of times when I'm reporting, it'll be, you know, on the government or whoever, and I don't care if they're mad at me. You know, that's they're always going to be upset when you're doing your job right. But these were just average civilians, and it was a bummer. Like, I really liked them, and I spent a lot of time getting to know them, and I did see their side of things in that sense, and it sucked, but I knew that everything I wrote was factual, it was accurate, and they thought they didn't look great in that sense. And you know, how do you look great when you're running a pageant for 100 years about the enslavement and genocide of Native Americans. Like, that's not, it wasn't me saying that. It came out in the piece, you know. It was a bummer. I was sad. I liked them, and I thought they were good people, so I was sad they were mad at me.
Do you hate them now?
No, they were really great people. They let me in their home. They let me follow them. I mean, you know, it was, that's, I think the hardest part is like when people allow you into their lives and then they're mad at you. But, you know, I did my job. I reported factually. I followed them. That's the great part about audio too, is like, yes, of course you can cut things to, you know, make someone say something differently. Again, we have a very high standard for that. You know, when you're reporting for a place like NPR, you can't do that. So that was kind of the good thing about it. I didn't make them say anything they didn't say. I mean, they said some things that were just like,
you said NPR, which is going to set Tim off.
Speaking of NPR, obviously you learned a lot from us and Missing More Murray and everything, but what have you learned from working at NPR?
So just because it always happens, it's not you guys, but the show aired on NPR. I didn't work for NPR, but either way, I had to follow NPR rules and standards. I mean, I learned a lot. There's a lot of rules, you know, there's a lot of checking with legal. Can you do this? Can this happen? I mean, I really think that's, you know, this distinct line between being a journalist and being, you know, I guess a podcaster, citizen detective in that sense. It's like, there is a high bar, like NPR, myself, we very quickly could have gotten sued or, you know, lost credibility, and that you never want that to happen. As a reporter whose work was being aired on NPR, I am a liability for them. So they put their trust in people. So there's a lot of trust that goes into it. And I did learn a lot. And now I take that into, you know, between my undergrad in journalism, my master's in journalism, and working, having NPR rules and standards that I have to follow. I take all of that now, you know, almost a decade into my podcast, and I abide by so much of that. I think the only thing I do not abide by is now I feel like I can be more of an advocate and a more partial than before. Before, there was always this line where you're not an advocate, you're a journalist. And now I feel like I can finally, you know, be myself in that sense, where I can blend practicing journalism, but obviously I'm advocating for the wrongfully convicted.
Right. And it's like you're in charge of the reins. Like, you hold the reins there. And you've come from, you know, a pretty intense background of standards. So at the same time,
to be clear, you know, Amber Hunt from the Cincinnati Inquirer, who hosts and produces the Accused podcast, is my editor, and she does my fact checking, and she's a veteran journalist in, you know, for investigations. So besides me, you know, I do still have a safety net as well. So everything we are putting out, you know, is really, really vetted.
That's great.
It's pretty cool. You talked about covering that pageant that celebrates genocide. And yet we have conversations daily about the Maura Murray case, and almost daily you say, I've never seen anything like this. I think that's kind of remarkable. What were you thinking when you got into Maura's case and where it's at now?
Oh boy. I didn't think that the online stuff would be as bad as it is and has become. I never was a Redditor, a blogger, you know, I do know a lot of journalists use that. I think I went on Reddit one time for a source. My friend and I were trying to do a story about adult circumcisions. We like went on an adult circumcision page on Reddit to find like a person who wanted to talk to us about it. But other than that, like, I had truly, I had never spent time on Reddit. Yeah. It's a world that I don't like. I don't like that I got sucked into. I think it's fascinating. I think you guys having this idea of making a documentary about the characters in a specific high profile case where so much of it is based online is brilliant. I think especially today, there's so much of it that has become, it's just a world that is, and like, I don't know how much you guys talk to your partners about it, but like, I don't, I'm like, you don't even, it's just like a whole other, I'm like, I can't even begin to talk about this bizarre trolling rabbit holes.
Maggie, if you're saying that trolls and harassment and online threats and fake tips and someone using a voice changer, if you're saying that stuff is too much in a missing persons case, I don't know what to tell you. You've signed up for the wrong missing persons case.
It's wild. I truly, there are many, many days, I think you guys probably get the like fear and loathing texts where I'm like, why did I ever agree to do this? Like, it didn't benefit my life in any way. Like, I wanted to help a family, and now this is what's happening. Now I have stalkers. Now I have people threatening to kill me just because I wanted to help a family. Like, it's really, really horrible.
Yeah.
And what's equally kind of bizarre in the whole thing is how you are invested in this, but you haven't like dove in to contribute to what's happening online, right? You don't go on Twitter and go back and forth. So if we're texting, and James Renner often texts with us as well, he'll say something like, oh, this happened. And you're usually like, you usually comment with, oh, show me a screenshot, like catch me up on this.
I have no idea what's happening.
Right. You're still involved with Maura's disappearance, but you're not involved in that end of the media, the social media part of it. But it's fascinating to me that people think that you are, like, even though you don't comment.
And how many fake accounts do you have on Twitter,
yeah,
Maggie?
Right. Yeah,
I couldn't even figure out how to make my own. The only reason I have a Reddit account is because it was like the AMAs that Ask Me Anything years ago. I think it was like 2017. I truly have no idea. It was literally after the show.
Yeah.
And the only reason I was doing it, and I told this to Julie, Maura's sister, I said, the only reason I'm doing any kind of like public engagement in this sense is to help you. People are sending me tips. Like, I want to help you. I don't freaking care about engaging on Reddit. Are you kidding me? So the only reason I had a Reddit account was for that.
This is flying in the face of everything.
That doesn't track, Maggie. You're ready to argue back with people anytime someone says anything about you.
I have too much going on in my life to literally spend time arguing online. Like, are you freaking kidding me right now? Like, it's, I mean, yes, obviously I know you are, but like, like in just in general, I'm like, really? Like, I have no time to be online. I don't even have time to leave my house because I'm so busy working. Like, have you listened to my ads on my podcast? They're all like, oh my God, I don't get to sleep. I don't have time for meal prep. Get this like meal kit because I can't meal prep. Yeah,
I actually fast forward.
It's my life.
Yeah, hold on. You have ads? How did you get ads so fast?
Well, it truly is a bizarre set of circumstances. The Maura Murray case is unlike anything that anyone's ever seen. We hear that all the time. And, you know, it's sort of unfortunate because it would be great if some of the lesser known cases had this much attention. It just so happens that this one has all of the elements that is, I guess, appealing to everybody who wants to solve a mystery. But I don't know if people want to solve a mystery or they just want to scream their theory as loud as possible. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, like, why is it like that? I do think that. I think people need to feel important. You know, everyone wants to be seen and heard in a sense. And I think people find that outlet here. And I think it's really sad. I'm so happy now to be in this new community of wrongful convictions where every single person has a common goal. And that is to help the person who is wrongfully convicted. Like, so Jason Flom, he's on the board of directors of the Innocence Project. He has one of the only other like weekly telling a story, wrongful conviction. And I knew that when I was coming out with mine, they're just very different. His are very like interview based. And he's obviously Jason Flom and has a lot of connections. And mine is more like storytelling. But, you know, I was afraid. I was like, oh my God, are we going to have some like beef? You know, I don't know. I don't want to have beef. I want to work together. That's how I am. Jason Flom, I'm nobody. And his people reached out immediately to my people and said, like, let's do something. This is great. Can we advertise your podcast? The more attention on wrongful convictions, the better. And I was like, oh my God, this, what? Like, we're all friends. This is beautiful. Like, Everyone gets along. Everyone is grateful. Everyone is thankful. Everyone has the same goal. And it's scary that it's not like that in the Mora case. Sorry, guys. I'm onto a better world now.
So you're saying in your community of wrongful convictions, unlike the Maura Murray case, people who are in this wrongful conviction community, they don't launch fake accounts on Twitter and try to further their own theories.
I don't think these people
thoughts.
Would even understand what you're speaking about. Because it's serious. And that's the saddest part, is so much of Maura's case has become a joke. Like, in the saddest way, like, everything is so serious. Like, you know, we have a wrongful conviction, my podcast group now. We have a podcast group, and I know Jason Flom has a podcast group. And it's just people sharing petitions and people being like, you know, in my group, I make sure to say, like, hey, this person's wife, this person's husband, they're here to answer questions. Like, it is so serious. It's all very serious and productive. And to think about how many, like, trash-talking Facebook groups there are for Maura and trolls, and it's just, like, it's really sad.
Oh, man, maybe you should come back into the Maura Murray community and, you know, like, shake things up like the sheriff's back in town. And
We need that attitude. It's sorely missing.
They don't want me in that community. I'm done. I am where I'm wanted.
I'd rather talk to people in Rikers Island.
Yeah, I would. I would rather talk to people who, you know, want me to help them, who seek me out. You know, to say that, you know, the amount of people who do. And there were people reaching out to me to do things on Maura's case. And I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing this. It's...
Yeah.
So this is the official retirement announcement from Maggie Freeling on the Maura Murray case.
Anytime Julie asks me to do something, I will do it. And that's why I did it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like I need to or have to or am wanted to. I don't engage in the drama. I don't want anything to do with that. So, you know, that's it.
Your podcast is Unjust and Unsolved, and you speak with the wrongfully convicted. How do you know that they are wrongfully convicted?
Oh, can I guess? They contacted you and they're in prison and they said, hey, I'm wrongfully convicted. Put me on your show. And you're like, sure, let's have a phone call right now. I'll put it up tomorrow.
You got Zoom?
Exactly. Something close to that. But no, that's the joke, that everyone in prison is innocent. So at least for season one right now, I have an incredibly high bar. You know, they are either vetted by the Innocence Project. They have had investigators, you know, they've been covered enough where I've seen the evidence. And again, I go through case files. I look at this stuff. I talk to people. You know, like the one that just came out this week, Bob Ruff had investigated this case for months. It was on his podcast, Bob Ruff with Truth and Justice, who does a lot with the West Memphis Three. You know, as someone else, you know, he investigated this case. There have been many investigations on this case. You know, it's very obvious the facts show this person is innocent. So that's the bar I'm setting with season one. And I don't know if I told you guys this yet, because I just got this news, but one of the cases I was looking into covering, the investigator, so I'm actually going down in 2 weeks to meet with Jason Baldwin from the West Memphis Three. He has his own innocence organization, and I'm meeting with one of his private investigators. And so they're covering this case, and I figured, okay, this is great. Jason Baldwin's probably going to take this case. There's probably a very high bar for this person's innocence. You know, I talked to their advocate. And then when they finally went there and started speaking to their alibi witnesses, it kind of started to unravel. And the investigator called me and said, you know, this person might be innocent, but I would maybe stay away this season. You know, right now I would maybe stay away. So, you know, that's the bar that I'm really talking to investigators and people like that. So, but that was fascinating. You know, that was really sad too, because I spoke to him. And do I personally believe he's innocent? Yeah. But does that mean he's innocent? I don't know. Do I think he did enough time? Do I think 20 years is enough time? Yes. That's a whole other issue. That's the criminal justice system.
When you started doing this, did you expect to visit them in prison because you got interrupted by COVID, right?
Yeah, I did. I did. I got to visit JJ, and that was literally right. like the day the COVID announcement for, you know, all visitations stopping. Yeah. And you know, I had three interviews lined up in Texas death row. They don't have phones. So I have to visit them in person, you know, to do the interviews. And I don't see that happening anytime. So those are a lot of cases that are now getting pushed back that, you know, they're on death row. These are urgent stories that need to be told. And one of them I asked, I said, hey, you know, you write me a lot of letters. Can I have a voice actor, you know, say, you know, verbatim what you tell me in these letters? And he said, I do not want a voice actor on my case. So, you know, these are stories that we're pushing back. COVID's really, really interrupted a lot of this.
So did you consider how you would mentally prepare to interview somebody on death row? Because I can imagine that would be a bit trying.
Well, it's a learning experience. I am a nice person, and I did figure out with this one man who is who is a very salty is not the word, and there is no word to describe having 5 stays of execution and being on death row for 35 years. I'm just trying to help, and he had written me some letters. You know, I guess I sent him a book of crossword puzzles and Sudoku because I know that, you know, just from reading Damien Eccles' stories, you know, they just have books. They just have. So in one of my letters back to him, I just like sent some of this. I love Sudoku. I do it all the time. And he wrote me back being like, you know, don't patronize me. Like, I am a established lawyer. I don't need your silly Sudokus. And I was like, I'm learning. I, how do you talk to somebody on death row? What, you know, that man is a particularly like hardened person. You know, he was an innocent man who the system has completely screwed him over. He was almost executed 5 times. Of course he's going to yell at me for sending a Sudoku. And now I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel so stupid. Like how dare I, you know?
That's interesting. Talking about how hardened he is, and he's been there, you know, like lined up to be executed 5 times.
Well, I think people forget that death row is also solitary confinement. He's been in solitary confinement for 35 years.
But what if a person who has been in prison for so long and has had that boomerang of emotion, right? You're on death row. You're in solitary confinement. Oh, you're not. Oh, you're on death. You'd like, over and over and over, how does that person function when they get out into society?
Well, that's what I always say. I say when they get out, because I you know, want to put that positive energy into the world. You know, there's no programming in our system for people that are locked away for life. There is no kind of, you know, half of these people I speak with, you know, people who are on, who are doing life or on death row, a lot of them, depending on the state, can't even take classes or go to school because they say, you know, you're going to die here. We don't need to prepare you for anything. You're lesser than you're whatever, you know, we don't need to put resources into you. And then exactly, they get out. So I have another podcast coming out this fall, winter. It's a 6-part investigative or documentary series about a man who was expected to die in prison and he's been released, and it's following his story. You know, what does that look like to eat with a fork for the first time in 25 years? What's it like to shower on your own when you're not surrounded by people?
I mean, you're talking about like the simplest things in life, and then it's that, and then it's like, how does it feel when you go to apply for a job and you have to answer that question, and then you have to explain yourself, and you have to all like start from way behind everybody else before you can prove yourself. And we've been talking to Doreen Giuliano, who's John Juca's mother, and John Juca's been in prison for 19 years now.
It's 16. Yeah, this is a big New York case. Took place in Brooklyn.
And there is a victim, Mark Fisher, and there is a killer in prison, and then John Juca is also in prison. And his mother, Doreen Quinn Giuliano, actually, incredibly, went undercover to befriend one of the jurors on her son's murder trial, which he was convicted in. And she knew that he knew John, and she befriended him as a different person and got a confession from him, got it taped, and brought it to the judge, and it still didn't work. They actually did... what do they call, overrule his conviction at one point, and just recently, yeah, and then it was reinstated in 2019, I believe. So yeah, it's been quite a wild ride for John Juca.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is even if he gets out, so the process that they go through is that, you know, it's overruled and he's up for, you know, another trial, but in the interim they keep him in Rikers, so he gets transferred from one prison to another prison, and in the interim he's kept in Rikers, and that's just a tactic so that, and they dangle it in front of him and say just plead guilty, we'll give it, it'll be time served, you'll get out, but he's got so much pride, and not pride because pride can sometimes have a negative connotation, he has so much will and so much like belief in himself that he'll continue the path of saying I didn't do it, so why would I even say I did this, why is that going to be on my record? But literally he's in fear for his life at Rikers. I mean, you don't even have to be a true crime fan to know that Rikers is probably in the top five of the worst prisons in the world.
He was moved back upstate. Yeah he was there when his conviction was overturned and before it got reinstated, so he was there for maybe like 8 months or a year or something like that.
Yeah, that's something I learned doing this. Prisons and jails are different. Rikers is horrible. I mean, a jail is meant to hold you for, it's a holding, you know, it's right. Where you go overnight, or, you know, you're not supposed to be there for a long time. They are not sustainable for that. I mean, Khalif Browder, he was there for 3 years and killed himself. I mean, Rikers is a terrible place. So yeah, for Juca to be there for that long is also just, it's horrible.
He was saying that he had to tape books to himself, and just in case he was stabbed overnight, that it would at least be some protection.
Yeah, he saw people stabbed right in front of him. Yeah.
And that's the tactic that they use. I mean, there's no coincidence that they choose Rikers as the jail in which he's kept in the interim between.
They could have given him bail. I mean, at the point where his conviction was overturned, he was not a convicted murderer. He could have got bail.
Right. Well, that, I don't know if you guys followed Khalif Browder's story. He was only there for 3 years because he couldn't make bail. He couldn't make bail, and they kept him there for 3 years. I mean, the system is, I mean, I've stepped into a whole other world of like how disturbing our system is. Like when I was doing missing persons with you guys, like I know we had talked a bit about, Jane and John Doe's and, you know, the different kinds of systems that, NamUs and, you know, trying to find and identify somebody who's missing. I mean, that's a whole other mess. And then now I'm in this whole other mess of a world with bail and bond and appeals and going to the same judge who presided over your case and then appealing to them. It's a mess. Everything is a mess.
No doubt about it. And yeah, Lance, to your point about trying to get John to just plead. Yeah, you know, we had spoken with Doreen and she's in tears and saying, this is, you know, that's really tough to even hear your son saying, I'm not going to do that, when she knows he could be out if he just did. And we're trying to tell her, like, look, John would be an amazing advocate. He can be a speaker. He can have a podcast, for God's sake. And
not
be
on the
an
Obsessed
advocate.
Network.
Right. And try to make a living that way if he's out as a convicted
murderer.
Well,
that is like Jason Baldwin. They took the Alford plea. The West Memphis 3 took the Alford plea. So they were released and are allowed to say, I'm innocent, but are technically convicted killers. And Jason started his own organization. It's called Proclaim Justice. I didn't say that before, but Jason's organization is Proclaim Justice. And he's now trying to help other innocent people.
Yeah, we got to put you in touch with Doreen Quinn Giuliano. You've got to hear her story about going undercover. It's absolutely incredible.
It's amazing the things that, and I know this happens in missing persons cases all the time. You know, we have Alyssa Turney's sister, Sarah Turney, you know, these families that do anything and everything to get their loved one back or find some kind of closure. And I hear so much of this too with families and spouses of those wrongfully convicted. I mean, I would like to think I'm that kind of person that would do that too.
Well, I think you're on the right path. I really do. I think we had you on to talk about your show, and I think it's exactly the show that you need to do. It's exactly your show, and it's so important.
Absolutely, and it's fantastic. So check it out at unjustandunsolved.com. Also available podcast players everywhere. Check us out too, crawlspace-media. And check out the Disappearance of Maura Murray docuseries, 6-part docuseries that aired on the Oxygen Network. It is excellent, and we talk a little bit about our podcast in there, but you get to see Maggie, and we're in the show as well. But yeah, a lot of time spent in New Hampshire, a lot of time spent at the Applebee's in the White Mountains. And,
And I want to say, you know, I know we talked a lot about like the dark side of that particular case, but I mean, there is a real family and there is a real missing person. And I think, you know, you guys and myself, would agree. It's close. I mean, I feel like something's going to snap. So I thank you guys for doing, you know, everything you can for that case and that family. And I think, you know, the more people that do pay attention and know something can really help.
Thank you so much to the Outlier Podcast Festival. This was an absolute blast.
Thank you, Ever, for organizing this and for everybody who's watching. This is the first time we've done it, so hopefully everybody enjoyed it, and thank you so much. ¶¶